extinguished Andy's family for no apparent reason, sidelined his career, sent him into bankruptcy, ruined his health, and left him a shell of a man for a very long time.
Hey everybody, it's me, Shelby, with Hooks, Books, and Crime, and it's Craft and Story Time. The story I have for y'all today is In the Spirit of Halloween. It's not Halloween based, but it's definitely spooky. And I mean, really, when you hear it, it's, how is there not a horror movie about this? Or not even that, you would think it is a movie because it's stranger than fiction. Like, it's unbelievable what occurred. I apologize for my voice. My allergies are through the roof. We're getting so much rain and then heat, and my sinuses just cannot take it. I'm on day 5 since watching Unknown Number on Netflix. Y'all, I am still severely grossed out. I'm still pissed off and I'm still in shock. I don't know what's worse, the sexual aspect that she was texting her daughter or the kill herself part. I know the kill herself part is like the worst part, but I guess all I kept thinking about is she was making fun of her daughter for not being sexually active, basically. And let's say her daughter felt pressured to go ahead and have sex with Owen. Could you imagine the chastising and like disappointment her mother would have had with her, more than likely? And then she was the one who bullied her into it the whole time. Like, I'm so glad that didn't happen, because that would just be even more traumatic for that poor girl. Kendra deserves all the Quasimodo memes, lady. Gross. But okay, let's get going. If you're watching this on YouTube, as you can see, my Daria is not looking very Daria. That's my 90s character, by the way. Daria, she's like the coolest person to me. I think I just related to her a lot. My sister was very much like Quinn growing up, except I was the younger one. That's probably the only difference. And I wasn't as smart as Daria. I was smart, but not Daria smart, probably. And I loved to write, but I identified with her so much, probably to a fault, because it made me very bitchy and more sarcastic than I already was, which like really drove my mom crazy. But I had a good time being like Daria. But yeah, she's turned into like Daria Potter, because I made her pupils too big. I didn't make her beady little eyes. Oh well, though. All right, well, let's get going. We are in a little town called Pepperell, Massachusetts, and it's 1986. So 1986, a lot of latchkey kids, and really, you're still in that simpler time to be alive. There's no social media. Not even everybody has cable TV. Even that's like a foreign concept. And in this town are two sisters named Tina and Karen. Karen being the younger of the two, Tina's the older sister. And these two girls, actually, their mother has passed away recently from cancer, so they have to lean on each other a bit. And their father, he works a lot. Bills don't stop because life happens, unfortunately. So he's got to keep the money rolling in. But, you know, the girls aren't troublemakers. They aren't off doing these insane shenanigans. They're not inviting boys over and drinking and doing drugs. They're doing nothing like that. Really, I think it's a little bit more heartbreaking. The two sisters are actually, they spend a lot of their time holding seances and hope to connect with their mother. And one day, as they're holding one of these seances, they're asking questions, trying to reach their mother on the other side. And they actually get a response. And the response comes in the form of a knock. And the girls get excited, maybe a little scared, a little, you know, spooked out. But they keep asking. And it continues knocking in response. And the girls really think that they've actually connected with their mother, so they're pretty thrilled about it. They even go and tell their father, Frank, and Frank doesn't believe this, of course. He's an adult. He's more logical. If anything, he's actually concerned for his daughter's mental well-being at this point, if they feel like they're connecting with their mother. But he doesn't do anything about it. He doesn't take any drastic steps because he knows his girls are hurting. So after this happens with the knocking and they receive some type of contact or some type of confirmation that they've reached the other side, some weird things start happening in the house. Things start going missing. Items are moved around the house. And also, like, if the girls leave a room and turn off the lights back on. Same thing with the TV. And it keeps happening. Sometimes all the lights are on for some reason when they come home. And the girls are scared, but it's nothing. Nothing has jumped out and scared them right out. And they're there with each other. So, you know, they just keep it going. They don't tell their dad because They don't want him to, I don't even think they think he'd believe them. I know at one point they do tell their dad because they come home and again, all of the lights are on and they know they did not turn on all these lights, but nothing really comes from it. And that's until December 8th of 1986. On December 8th of 1986, the girls are out with their father Frank and they come home. And as they come home, Frank notices that, and this is like the worst way to meet, not the worst way, but not a nice way to find out someone's been in your house. He finds that someone has used the restroom and they didn't flush, so they left something gross in there. But seeing this, Frank's on high alert immediately, and he starts searching through the house. And as he enters one room, he's blindsided by a man who is wearing, before we go any further, I've heard two things about what this man's wearing. I've seen and heard where he's wearing his Frank's dead wife's wedding dress. Yikes. And I almost feel like this one might be more for the lore of the whole thing and not actually what happened. The other one is that he's in an oversized coat, which I think it's more the oversized coat considering it's December in Massachusetts. It's fucking cold. I feel like the oversized coat makes more sense. But this guy is in an oversized coat, has war paint all over his face, like, what? And he's carrying a hatchet. He's carrying a little axe. So upon seeing this, Frank freaks the fuck out. But unfortunately, this man takes them hostage. He has them all in a room. But luckily, one of the girls is able to escape out a window and she runs and gets help. When the officers arrive, they can't find anybody when they search the house. They're not sure how he got in, but there's no sign that that person's still there. He's gone. But naturally, after this traumatizing moment, they don't want to sleep in their house that night. They decide to go stay the night in a hotel. I mean, rightfully so. I mean, really, I feel like sleeping in your car would feel safer at this point than sleeping in that house. That's terrifying. So they go and stay in a hotel for about 2 days. On that second day, Frank returns to the house to check on it. And he does remember that when he left, he locked up the house, which of course, right, you just had an intruder. Obviously, you're going to make sure the house is secured. So as he's approaching the house and he's getting closer, he's coming up on his porch, the man jumps out in front of the window and waves at him. Like, what the fuck? Nightmare fuel. Seriously. Frank fucking bolts and runs to his neighbors and calls the police again. The police arrive quickly and they search the house. And one of the first things the police notice when entering the house that the officer notices, he notices there's two family portraits that are on the walls. Each of them have a knife stabbed through the center of it and a note. The first note says, "I'm still here. Come find me." My heart would just drop. The second one says, "I'll kill you all." Terrifying. So as police are searching, you know, there's officers searching the interior, and then there's officers searching the exterior. And both sides are a little confused because there are no signs of a break-in. There's no broken windows. There's nothing going on with the doors. Everything is as it should be. So they don't know how this person got in. They don't know how he's got out. They know he's still in the house. There's no way he would have got out. But the problem is they're searching top to bottom. They cannot find this person. But then they go down to the basement. And the officer goes into the basement and, you know, he's looking around. He's still not seeing anything. But then he looks up at the ceiling and he sees the pipes, all the plumbing and everything going through. And then they actually lead down the wall. And he notices, obviously, you don't want those pipes visible throughout the house, right? So they actually built a false wall to hide those pipes. And he thinks to himself and realizes that false wall creates a crawl space just big enough for a person to fit. So he goes looking in there. And when he enters, he notices that there's like a mound of laundry right around the wall. And it doesn't make any sense because obviously no one would be throwing laundry behind this wall. Also, that amount of laundry, it was so much to where they wouldn't have any clothes left really to be wearing. So he starts picking apart this laundry mountain, if you will. He starts picking articles of clothing off of it. And eventually, you know, as he's pulling off these pieces, he suddenly sees a tuft of black hair and an eye just looking at him like this from the corner. Yikes. Obviously, the officer starts telling him to freeze, put your hands up slowly. And eventually, this kid gets out and he is a kid. It turns out it's a boy named Daniel LaPlante, and he is 16 years old. So police are like horrified. So they're looking at where he's been hiding. And what they find is they find, you know, stuff for him to sleep on. They find a bunch of food wrappers, beer bottles, bottles of piss. They find a bunch of shit. And it comes out that he's been living in this family's crawl space and walls for at least 6 months. 6 months. Which, where are his parents that he's there for 6 months and nobody notices? Or they just don't care? Like, that should already tell us what kind of people we're dealing with, honestly. So, and the thing is, Frank doesn't know who Daniel LaPlante is. He has no idea who this kid is. But Tina knows him. See, Tina and Daniel are acquainted with each other because they went on a date together. But on this date, Tina was caught very much off guard by Daniel. Because so she didn't know Daniel when she went out with him. Daniel had called her one day and he told her that he went to school with one of her friends and that's how he got their number, but he attended a different school. And I mean, that's how it was back then. Without social media, you couldn't like lurk on people's pages and be weird like that. You know, let's be mutuals. You can't do that shit. So that actually is how people met and stuff. So they're talking and getting to know each other. And then she decides and agrees to go have ice cream with him. But upon meeting Daniel, she realizes that Daniel, I mean, he basically catfished her. He looks nothing like how he described himself to her. I think he had told her that he was like on a foot, like, you know, he was on the football team and stuff like that. And yeah, he looked nothing of the sort. And not just that, he was odd and awkward and weird, and he made her uncomfortable. So after this date, Tina decided, you know, that's it. She wasn't interested in having a second date, which she's allowed to. You do not have to keep seeing someone if the first date's not a hit, whether female or male. You don't have to, unless you were doing some shit like where you went on one date and you made them buy you a bunch of bullshit and everything. Then you know what, that person's rightfully to be a little annoyed because you clearly use them. That's not the case here. Rightfully so. She wasn't interested after the first date. She doesn't have to agree, and she doesn't have to agree to anything else. And also, this is why they thought they were getting a response during their seances. It was Daniel knocking. He was moving around through their walls, watching the girls' every move, because remember, their dad wasn't home. And also, which is why all of his bullshit would stop when their father got home, because he could see. He would actually move the electrical outlets out of the wall and peek through them and then look through vents and everything. So these girls had no idea that they were basically being spied on. Who knows what else this jerk saw? He's arrested and he's actually sent to a state hospital for a mental evaluation, where he is diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. And he sent to juvie. And you know, the girls and Frank are like, okay, good, you know, good riddance. However, when Daniel turns 17, the judge decides that Daniel is going to be charged as an adult for the crimes committed in the case with Tina, with the Bowens. You know, the stalking and everything, basically. So, because he's now going to be tried as an adult, he's given the opportunity for bail. And his mother, she is involved, apparently. Only when things like this happen, I guess. His mother remortgages her house in order to put up the bond, or the bail. So, okay. And he's out and about. So on December 1st, 1987, almost a year after what happened with the Bowens, Andrew Gustafson is coming home. And we're actually in the neighboring town now of Townsend, Massachusetts. And Andrew Gustafson is getting home from work. And he's concerned and nervous and anxious because he had been calling home a few times that day. And his wife, Priscilla, hadn't answered. Nor has she called him back. He gets home and he comes home to a very quiet house. And this is even more unsettling for Andrew because they have two small children, William and Abigail. So Andrew goes upstairs looking for them because he's calling their names and nobody's answering. And upon entering his bedroom, Andrew finds his wife Priscilla on the bed, laying on her back, one arm tied to the bedpost, and she's got a pillow covering her face. And the pillow is covered in blood. Andrew immediately runs downstairs, runs out of the house, and calls the police. When asked like why he didn't look for his children, he just said that he couldn't bear the thought of finding them. And I can't blame him. I'm sure he knew something was very wrong and that something had happened to his kids. Something similar had happened to his children. or they just weren't there. So police arrive at the Gustafson house and they find his wife Priscilla deceased in their bed, and then they go into the upstairs bathroom. There they find William Gustafson, their young son, I think he's 5 at the time, drowned in the bathtub, which is just so ugly for someone to do to anybody, let alone a child. But they still need to find Abigail. And as it is, I forgot to mention, Priscilla was also heavily pregnant. She wasn't due, but she was definitely closer to her due date than the beginning of a pregnancy. She's at least more than halfway through it. So as police are looking, and then they go into the restroom downstairs, and in the downstairs restroom bathtub, they find Abigail Gustafson, and she's been drowned as well. Now, police are horrified. I have no doubt that experiencing this, they knew automatically that this is going to be something that haunts them for the rest of their lives. The images of finding those children and the wife, I have no doubt that those stayed with them. It's so awful. Like, drowning someone is just so intimate already because you have to be up close and personal to it. You have to watch it. You have to feel them fighting for their life because instinct kicks in for them to get out of the water. And then to do it twice is just, there's no word for it of how atrocious and horrid that is. It's terrible. So, of course, Andrew Gustafson is questioned. You always gotta look at the husband. He's ruled out very quickly. But when they start questioning Andrew, you know, if there's anything he can think of, any enemies, has anything unusual been happening? He actually says, you know what? Yeah, there have been some unusual activities at home. He says that somebody had come into their house while they were out and stolen two of their cable boxes, the remotes to the cable box. He says that things had been moved around the house, but that was it. There hadn't been any physical threat, and they didn't know who it was. So upon hearing this, and the details are being spread throughout Massachusetts, this story made national headlines. And one of the lieutenant who is there in Townsend working this case immediately thinks of the story he had heard a year before and thinks this sounds like something Daniel LaPlante would do. But to him, Daniel LaPlante is still in juvie. But then they learn that he's not. They can try to confirm that he's still in juvie. And that's when they learn that he got put out on bail. And around the time that he got bailed out, a lot of burglaries had been taking place in Townsend, Massachusetts. And they didn't have a suspect. And now it's looking like, oh my God, Daniel LaPlante's been in all these people's houses lately. But they don't have any evidence. They just have coincidence. So at the crime scene, they actually noticed, because this town is pretty rural and it's very woodsy. So where the Gustafson's house is, you have the backyard. And then like bordering the backyard is the woods. And they notice that outside in the backyard is a pillow. So upon seeing this pillow, they decide to get the canine unit. The dog picks up on a scent and leads them through the woods. As they're going through the woods, they're actually finding some discarded evidence, including gloves, a pair of gloves that have been thrown. This dog leads them directly to Daniel LaPlante's house. And because of that, now they're able to get a search warrant of Daniel LaPlante's house. When they search his house, they find a pair of wet socks that also have a hair matching Abigail Gustafson's hair color. And they find shells that match the bullet that Priscilla. So they back this up and issue a warrant out for Daniel's arrest. And Daniel, he must have known that they were on his tail because he fled. He never returned back to his house. And what's scary about this is a kid who was not afraid to enter people's houses while they're home. And he's good at hiding. So he's definitely someone you want to get off the streets as soon as possible. And not just that. You know, people do crazy things when they're desperate and backed into a corner. All this stuff that Daniel did to the Gustafsons, like the police didn't even know he was out on bail. There was no pressure or anything pushing him to take such drastic measures. He just did it. So the fact that he would now know that the walls are closing in on him, who knows what he's capable of if that was nothing to him. The savagery that would come out if he's backed into a corner is terrifying. So they need to move, and they need to move fast. And the lieutenant decides to check one, like the certain north part of the woods. That's where he feels that Daniel would head, because Daniel's shown already that he's very familiar with it. So now as they're going there, an officer stumbles on a woman who's hanging around outside her house, and she flags him down. And, you know, people are scared. Her house is empty. She's the first one home. And she asked the officer if he'd be willing to enter the house with her because she's scared to go in by herself. And the officer's just like, sure. You know, he understands it. You know, better yet, if the house was empty, he might have known. Of course I'll escort you in. Quickly after they enter the house, they hear this loud thud that hits the floor, like something or someone dropping. And he looks at her and he asks her, is there anybody in this house? Do you have a dog? And she says, like, no, I only have a cat, which to him, it sounded too heavy to be a cat, which I'm very curious because I swear to God, my fat ass cat, I can hear her jumping off of shit upstairs all the time while I'm downstairs. And I swear she makes me think there's someone up there because she sounds so loud. It sounds like a person. It's insane. But so he goes up there to check. And when he reaches the second floor at the top of the stairs, he finds a shotgun just laying at his feet. So this is most definitely confirmation that Daniel's here. They search the house and he is gone. Daniel's gone. He was actually able to slip out of the second story window, land on the garage, and take off. But, you know, her husband arrived, so police have them check everything to see if anything's missing. Anything weird, things that don't belong there. And her husband does confirm that the shotgun that they found at the foot of the stairs is his. But he's missing a handgun. So police are like, oh shit, like, great, now this kid's fucking armed. So, I mean, they're telling people to stay inside. Do not come outside. Don't let your kids outside. Lock all your doors. They're making the whole town aware that nobody is safe. And this person will do whatever they have to do. But luckily, a tip comes out, like, soon, not too long after this happens at the house, at this woman's house. They get a tip of a strange man in the woods, or leaving the woods and going to a lumberyard that's not too far. So they head to the lumberyard. And in this lumberyard, there's really only one place that someone could hide. And that is by the dumpster or inside the dumpster. So they surround the area and police are expecting a gunfight at this point. They surround the dumpster and Daniel LaPlante does surrender, luckily without incident. And he's taken into custody. So Daniel does go to trial for three murders, Priscilla, Abigail, and William. And when they start coming, like showing the evidence, everything that was mentioned is mentioned at trial. But also, when they searched Daniel's house, they also found their murder weapon. They found the gun that was used to kill Priscilla. And they found the cable boxes and remotes that were stolen from the Gustafson's house. So with all of this, Daniel LaPlante is sentenced to life in prison. He gets three life sentences consecutively. However, this was, you know, in the late 80s, this conviction. Massachusetts does overturn. So later on in time, it's decided that it's cruel and unusual for a minor to be sentenced to life in prison with no parole. So Daniel's sentence actually gets downgraded and his three life sentences get shortened down to 45 years. Meaning Daniel LaPlante will actually be eligible for release in 2033, in 8 years. That is just, I don't know. And see, and the thing with Daniel LaPlante is, Daniel LaPlante is definitely a good case for the nature versus nurture argument. Because when you look into Daniel LaPlante's home, or like his upbringing, he had a very hard life. It doesn't seem like he grew up in poverty or anything where they went without. But every adult failed him. See, Daniel was abused in all sorts of ways. In all kinds of ways. Physically, sexually, mentally, verbally. He was abused by his father, as well as his psychiatrist. And a bunch of other adults who were supposed to be there to look out for him and to help him. They all failed him. He was one of those kids who just slipped through the cracks. And anytime somebody tried to get him help, they would just take advantage of his situation. So Daniel LaPlante, we don't know if this is someone who was born evil, or if he was made evil because of everything that everyone's ever done to him. Hurt people hurt people. And not everybody, of course, who's gone through horrible things commits any crime, let alone crimes like this. But it is always a wonder of what would have happened to this person if they were born into a family that just loved them, just encouraged them, and did everything that they could have done to make this person a great citizen, a good addition to society. But that's not what we have here. I always wonder that, like, what would have happened? And the thing is, Daniel LaPlante was highly intelligent. He's very smart. So, you know, and that bears the question too, when they're that smart, would he have always been manipulative? Would he have stayed this cunning? Or would he have found an interest that would have been encouraged, that his parents could have encouraged and done something great? We'll never know. But that is the horrifying story of Daniel LaPlante. It's, like I said, stranger than fiction. The idea that somebody's living in your house for 6 months and moving things around, it's like poltergeist, but a real person. It's not even a ghost. That poor family. How do you recover from such a thing? I would hope they moved to a different house. Well, I don't know. You know he's gone. You know he's arrested, but it's still terrifying. Like, and I just always wonder, like, you think they'd like to be at home alone? I don't think I could. Any little sound would freak me out. Yeah, I'm going to try to start doing these weekly so I can push out more for y'all, especially now that I like this whole two-screen thing. I really enjoy it. I'm hoping this side got everything. I noticed my phone went black for a second, so I'm hoping that doesn't impact it too much. But yeah, you know, please follow, like, subscribe, comment, share everything, and I'll catch you on the next one. Okay, bye.